Welcome to the Drinking with the Saints podcast. I'm your host, Mike Foley.
And I'm a co-host, Alexandra Foley.
And welcome. Let us begin, as we always do, with a prayer. Stay with us, O Lord, for it is getting towards evening, and bless our drinks and our conversation.
Amen.
Well, in a couple of days, it is going to be the feast of St. Bernard of Clairvaux. His feast day falls on August 20th. And boy, was he a remarkable saint. Now, Alexander, you, right before we got on, said, oh, I really like him. Can you tell us why?
My spiritual reading every day for the last couple of years in the morning has been a lovely book called Divine Intimacy. And they, especially in the Marian months, May and October, they quote heavily from Bernard of Clairvaux. And it's always so tender about the Blessed Virgin. It's just so clear that he just truly loved her as a mother. It just always touches me the way he speaks of her. So that's all.
And there are a couple of famous stories about his devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary, which we will get to.
They're cheeky.
They're pretty cheeky, actually, by our standards, which is interesting. We'll have to talk about that and why. Mm-hmm. But one interesting thing about Bernard of Clairvaux was, in a sense, his versatility. Mm-hmm. He's not the founder of the Cistercian order, but he is revered by the Cistercians as if he were. Because they were still relatively young when he joined, and when he joined, then they really took off. Mm-hmm. For one thing, he persuaded so many people to join the Cistercian order with him. He was this handsome, very charming French nobleman, and when he told his family that he was going to become a Cistercian, his uncle? How many uncles?
An uncle and four brothers.
Tried to talk him out of it. Mm-hmm. And instead,
didn't work.
He talked them into joining.
So not only uncle, four brothers, but then 24 local noblemen.
Yeah.
And wasn't there also a story about a little boy who was left behind?
So most of his brothers joined him, except like the baby of the family, who was like 10 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. And the youngest kid in those days got nothing in terms of inheritance, right? Primogeniture. All of them, all his older brothers left, and as they were leaving, they said, hey, little Pierre, good news, the estate's yours. Mm-hmm. And he says, what? Will you take heaven and leave me only earth?
Oh, it's so tender.
And he joined as well.
Wow. They all forsook their inheritance. Yeah. For a greater inheritance.
I think that estate is still for sale. So yes, he is renowned for his Cistercian fervor. He is renowned for his works on love.
I've heard him referred to as a lover and a fighter.
Indeed, a lover of God and the Blessed Virgin Mary, and a ferocious fighter against religious laxity and academic arrogance. Mm-hmm. He's famous for both his love and his fights. He is famous for his works on love and his devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. But he also wrote a very stirring treatise called In Praise of the New Knighthood, which is about the Knights Templar. And it is feisty. It's the fight of the knight.
Yeah.
I use that when I teach my medieval course at Baylor University. And it's interesting because it alarms students at first. But when you actually dig deep into it, you realize, oh, he's not advocating jihad. This isn't just sort of like a ruthless holy war. Mm-hmm. But he does provide a defense of a Christian taking up arms in a rather vigorous way.
And there's the fighter. It's funny, I mentioned the lover part of being the lover of Our Lady, and you mentioned the fighting part. And so he lived around the 1100s, early 1100s.
That's right.
In Clairvaux, France. Yep. Which is
so he defended the Crusades.
Southeast of Paris.
And he was against academic arrogance, because another fight that he's famous for having is the fight with Abelard.
Of Eloise and Abelard?
Yep. And so Peter Abelard was an extremely impressive and brilliant theologian, but there is a way in which he was too clever for his own good and said some things that he shouldn't have done. He actually did help develop the field of theology, Abelard. But he flew a little too close to the sun and said doctrinal things that he shouldn't have. And Bernard of Clairvaux, who loved purity of doctrine, went after him with a vengeance. Mm. I mean, he kind of had to. Like, if you get into the ring with Abelard, you got to be prepared for a...
He's not going to go down easy.
He's not going to go down easy. Mm-hmm. So the two of them went at it, and Bernard won. Mm. Even though he wasn't an academic, he was not... He was not a brilliant theologian in the way that Abelard was.
Right.
He's an excellent theologian and a doctor of the church. So, you know, that's no lightweight, but still, yeah, he's just fascinating.
So what's the drink?
Okay. The Cistercians are most famous for the offshoot of the Cistercians, the Trappists. And that is, of course, Trappist beer.
Heard of it.
It's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to have something to drink right now. We don't, unfortunately, have Trappist beer on hand. So we're going to turn to a legend about St. Bernard of Clairvaux to inspire a cocktail choice.
Okay. Because my throat's gone dry.
Exactly. So Bernard is called the Mellifluous Doctor because of his charming, sweet eloquence. Mm. But as you know, he's renowned for his devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And there are two legends in particular that are noteworthy.
Mm-hmm.
One is he loved Mary so much that every time he passed her statue, he would say, "Hail Mary."
Mm-hmm.
And then on one occasion, he passed the statue and said, "Hail Mary." And the statue said,
"Hail Bernard."
Exactly.
I think that's such a sweet story. Try to do that when I pass the statue, is to say Hail Mary. Like, just Hail Mary, not the whole thing.
Got you.
Hail Mary. Just reminds you of, like, you say Hail Mary and you think of it, well, it's the beginning of the prayer, but you're saying, "Hello, Mary."
Yeah.
"Hey, Mary."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hail.
We're trying to think of Heil.
Yeah, that's right. But the most famous or colorful legend story about St. Bernard.
Just remember, Mike, this is a PG show.
But this is what's so interesting. There is an artistic tradition called the Lactation of Bernard. And you can Google this and look up pictures of the Lactation of Bernard. And it depicts the Mother of God squirting or sprinkling her breast milk onto St. Bernard while the infant Jesus is taking a break from feeding.
Any nursing mother knows when that baby gets off you, that can happen.
Exactly. So in honor of this legend, we're going to make ourselves a milk and honey. The Mellifluous Doctor is the honey part, and the milk is the lactation part.
That's a perfect combo.
It is. And then we're going to talk about the lactation of Bernard and why.
Why is everyone in the room blushing?
Exactly. So let's get the drink.
All right. It's drink time. This is called the milk and honey, and it involves really just three ingredients. And you're going to use a highball glass, which we've talked about different kinds of glasses in our previous podcasts. The highball is kind of the tall, skinny guy, in contradistinction to the lowball, which is like an old-fashioned glass, short and stout. So you're going to fill, Mike, a highball full of glass. Sorry, did I say? And I haven't even had that cocktail yet. You're going to fill a highball glass with ice. And then you're going to put an ounce and a half of Irish mist. Tell us about Irish mist, Mike.
Irish mist is a very interesting mixed whiskey. It's whiskey and local honey and a couple of other herbs and spices. It's made in Tullamore, Ireland.
Oh, so is it by the same makers of Tullamore Dew?
I know they have a common origin. I don't know if they're made by the same company anymore.
Okay. People who don't like it call it Tullamore Don't.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'm pouring in the Irish mist.
And then you're going to do milk. It doesn't say how much.
I think you just fill up the highball.
Okay. I believe you. So I'm reading that Irish mist has flavors of honey, and as you mentioned, and cinnamon and cloves. And it's a very mild whiskey base. And then you're going to sprinkle the top with cinnamon. Seems like a good bedtime drink. Personally, I don't want like a milky drink. In our last show, we made the drink for St. Clair that was a milk base, which is just a really great drink and fun by poolside. But generally speaking, in my cocktail hour, which usually happens at 5 o'clock, if it's a bad day, a little earlier, I don't really want a milky drink with my cocktail hour, but maybe that's just a lactation thing or lactose thing for me. Ah, okay.
All right.
Here's our drink.
All right, to St. Bernard.
St. Bernard.
Cheers.
Cheers. Pray for us. Not bad. That's good. There's honey and cinnamon. Go figure.
Exactly.
And whiskey.
It's sweet, but not cloying.
Mm-hmm. Not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
All right. So
again, I think it'd be a great before bed drink, though.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we could turn in early if you want. So while we sip our drink, the discussion I think we should have is, what on earth is going on with this artistic tradition of the lactation of Saint Bernard?
And as you mentioned, why is it weird to us?
Yeah.
Are we just more uptight nowadays? I mean, this tradition, yeah. This is a medieval tradition.
Yep. I mean, one thing I find interesting is that we moderns think of ourselves as so liberated.
Sure.
And we are in touch with our feelings and we're not repressed, especially not sexually repressed, the way earlier generations were. Mm-hmm. And yet, it seems like the medievals were much more comfortable with the body.
Right. We are uncomfortable with the body nowadays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we claim to be liberated and at home with ourselves, but we really are still kind of uptight. Mm-hmm. Whereas the medievals that we defame as being uptight are showing pictures of saints breastfeeding from the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Right. Yeah. Now there's this weird thing. I mean, I haven't had a nursing baby for 11 years, but, women not being able to nurse in public, people freaking out because you're nursing your baby in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, what the heck is wrong with us? Like, you're eating your nachos over there and this baby's having his milk. What's your problem?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, is it part of it because it's the Blessed Virgin?
So there is a tradition of lactation paintings of Madonna and child, right? So not just the Blessed Virgin Mary holding the infant Jesus, but nursing the infant Jesus.
Is there anything more beautiful than seeing a mother nurse a baby? I just think it's just so lovely to see.
I'll agree. So yeah, it's an interesting tradition, and I'm grateful that it's there. But if there was a new Catholic church being built.
Right, and a new St. Bernard's down the road.
Yeah, so there's a St. Bernard of Clairvaux being built. Would you recommend that a new painting portraying the lactation be commissioned?
100% I would.
Would you?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
For some reason, I would be hesitant to do that.
It would get a lot of attention.
It sure would. It's especially if you posted it outside the church, put it on a billboard as people are driving by.
With mass times.
Exactly.
It's our best attended mass yet. I think it's so neat. We shouldn't be so uptight.
This is a complete side note, but this does remind me that, remember the huge campaign, Got Milk?
Very much.
They wanted to do the same campaign in Mexico, but they had trouble with translation. Because in Spanish, when you phrase the question, got milk, it basically means, are you lactating?
Did you get your milk? Has your milk come in?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Did you get your milk? Very different meaning.
I'm picturing a whole new ad campaign with Bernard of Clairvaux.
Got milk.
Exactly. All right. One other thing to talk about with respect to this great saint is Trappist beer, which to this day, despite the explosion of craft beer and microbrews, remains the finest beer in the world.
So he was a Trappist?
So the Trappists are a branch of the Cistercians.
So Cistercian is the trunk?
Yes.
Okay.
And the Trappists are a branch of that tree.
One of these days we should do like a whole thing on monastic orders because it always confuses me, all the different ones. Like we're talking about one of our episodes about the Discalced.
Yeah.
Different branches of Poor Clares or the Carmelites.
What's that joke? What are the three things that not even God knows?
Right.
And one of them is what the Jesuits are really up to.
Yeah, that's right.
The second is how much money the Jesuits have.
Yeah.
And the third is how many women's religious orders there are.
Fewer and fewer. That's right. Actually, more and more now.
Yeah. So the Trappists, I believe, they're an even stricter observance of the Cistercian rule. So it's kind of interesting. The Cistercians got started because they thought the Benedictines were too lax. And then over time, they got lax, the Cistercians, not during Bernard's day. He was a toughie.
So they get lax.
But they eventually got lax. And then the Trappists were a sort of extreme version of the Cistercians to correct that laxity.
So what's the name Trappist come from?
La Trappe. I think it's from the place in France where they got started.
I think I've been there with my parents long ago. Mm-hmm. Thomas Merton. What was he?
Trappist.
Yeah.
Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky.
Yeah, that's Trappist. That's right. Okay. Little trivia.
That's right. And they have an interesting association with alcohol. They make delicious brownies and fruit cakes with Kentucky bourbon. And the reason why they do is that guests come to them in Kentucky and leave as gifts bottles of bourbon, but the Trappists don't drink hard liquor. So they had this huge cellar just filled with bottles of bourbon that they could not consume. And finally, the baker had this brilliant idea, let's put them in our Christmas goods. And now they're just, you know,
it's a great business.
Selling like hotcakes.
It's a great place to go to for your Christmas gifts. We often do that for people.
Trappist
fudge and the cakes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So why is it that the Trappists make the best beer in the world? What do you think?
Did they ever become lax? Was there something after the Trappists?
Not that I know of.
Okay. And they don't drink? They don't drink hard liquor.
They don't drink hard liquor. They do drink. I think they will drink their beer, their own beer. Mm-hmm. But is that why they make the best beer?
So before we talk about that, tell us more about like how everybody used to drink beer or wine, that basically was drinking water because drinking water was unsafe.
That is true. So there are a couple of patron saints of brewers, for example, both named St. Arnold, interestingly enough, Arnold of Soissons and Arnold of Metz, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
But they are both patron saints of brewers because they both urged their diocese to drink beer instead of water during a time of plague. Mm-hmm. Because water contained waterborne pathogens.
Whereas, isn't that what we all did during coronavirus? Just drink more? And look at us, we're alive.
Believe me, the first thing I did was look up what kind of proof do you need to kill the coronavirus? Unfortunately, it was beyond human consumption.
Yes, remember it was the quarantini?
Exactly. But yeah, you could even add beer or wine to the water and have it still be low in alcohol. So you wouldn't get buzzed necessarily, but it had just enough alcohol to kill germs and other bad things.
So. Okay. So everyone, you know, it's not weird that monks, like I know nowadays people who aren't familiar with Catholicism might say, it's so weird that, you know, monks would make alcohol of any kind. It's because, you know, they don't do anything fun. A, that's not true. But B, even in strict orders, everyone's drinking alcohol for health reasons.
Yeah, that's true. So small beer was defined as beer that is fit for women, children, and day laborers.
Okay. I have been all of those things.
So,
but I still prefer the strong beer.
Well, the idea was a day laborer could drink this during the day and it would not impact his job performance or... But it would keep them safe from waterborne pathogens.
So it sounds like you're encouraging day drinking. Let's cheers to that.
Cheers. So it's small beer because it's low in alcohol. Uh-huh. It's what used to be like 3-2 beer in the United States, which back in the day you could buy when you were 18. Mm-hmm.
This drink is, by the way, really growing on me.
Okay.
The Irish Mist.
Excellent.
Yes.
So there's certainly nothing scandalous about monks making beer. The question still remains, though, why is it the best beer?
I don't know, because they're not really, I mean, are they making money off of it?
Yeah.
What are the Norsha? Those are Franciscans?
Those are Benedictines. So we're talking about the Trappists, and there are, now they've grown. I think there are now 12 monasteries that can carry the label Trappist beer.
Okay.
It used to be 8, and they were all in Belgium. And then it's grown. And then just within the last 15 years, for the first time in Trappist history, there is now Trappist beer being made in the Western Hemisphere, Spencer, Massachusetts.
Oh, of course.
St. Joseph.
And my home state.
Their beer is outstanding. But what's interesting is that it's very different from the Abbey ales that are being produced in Europe, which are delicious, but they're darker, they're heavier, they're maltier. Mm-hmm. The Trappist beer that's being made in Spencer is very light, effervescent, hoppy. So a really different kind of monastic beer, but excellent nonetheless.
So two things. Is that what Spencer is doing? Is that based on what they have locally, that they're making something that's more hoppy?
I don't know. I don't know why they went in a different direction. Maybe because their elder brethren had already sort of cornered the market with all these other kinds of double ale and triple ale and that kind of thing.
Little brother's got to be unique.
He does, exactly.
And then you mentioned that all the Trappist monasteries are in Belgium.
So there are Trappist monasteries all over the world. Mm-hmm. But
the beer-making ones.
But if you are a Trappist monastery and you want to make your own beer, to call it Trappist beer, you have to get permission from HQ. And there are strict criteria.
Does that mean headquarters?
Exactly. And I don't know exactly how their chain of command works, but they can't just give themselves the title.
Okay.
And there are strict criteria. One of them is that Trappists are responsible for every step of production. I don't think they have to grow their own barley or hops or malt or whatever.
Okay. Good.
But from the moment the fermentation process begins up to the bottling, mm-hmm. it is Trappist and Trappist alone.
Okay.
They can't hire employees. They can't outsource it. So there are a number of very strict requirements.
Okay. Well, maybe you answered your own question because there's strict requirements.
So they're strict. Mm-hmm. I also think there's, you know, the old Benedictine motto, ora et labora.
I was going to say that.
Well, why didn't you?
Because I was actually just trying to remember if they were the same, Benedictines and Trappists.
So Trappists don't have that as their motto, but the idea right. is all the monks, what do? They work and they pray. And their work becomes a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So
we make for whatever good product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like
having a prayerful appropriation.
The right. liqueurs. Anything, or like another day, we're going to talk about chartreuse by the Carthusians. Whatever these guys do, they do prayerfully, and the result is excellent.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they have some heavenly help too, Mike.
That's possible. They also have some earthly help. One advantage to being a monastery is a long institutional memory. So they are able to pass down these skills from one generation sure. to the next.
And they're perfecting.
Yep.
It's not like reinventing the wheel every year.
That's right.
These are all actually kind of good reminders of just how to be an effective worker in general.
Yeah.
Or how to live your life, you know, or labora, you know, pray through your work.
Yep.
And then, you know, be traditional. Don't yeah. do what your grandmother did.
Right.
You know, take what's best of the old and improve it if it needs improving, but just don't make things up.
That's right. And tradition isn't just simply,
tradition do the exact
is not
same
blindly
thing.
Repeating the past.
Right, exactly. It's perfecting. Tradition means literally handing down.
Exactly.
And so you take what's been handed down to you, and then maybe you, you know, polish it up or yeah. you change it or, you know, you modernize it in some way.
Exactly.
And that's good, but you just don't make it out of whole cloth every time.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that the way the Trappists make beer today is different than they did 500 years ago.
Right.
But I'm sure there's also a continuity.
Yeah.
There's something recognizable about it, even if it has changed with circumstances or whatever.
It's so neat, this whole renaissance of local things and craft beers and craft liquors, that how many people now who are, you know, they're just regular people starting a whiskey company or something, but that they're looking to what's been done for thousands of years in these monasteries to learn. That's really neat.
It's cool. And the monks still lead the way.
And
we mentioned the Trappists, but you mentioned the monks of Norcia. They're Benedictines. They also make an outstanding beer.
They are definitely orying that laboring.
Exactly.
Such good beer.
Yeah.
They sent us a whole case.
They did.
Because you taught them a class and they wanted to pay you. And you said, well, instead, can you just send me some beer? They sent us two big boxes of beer, probably worth much more, especially being sent from Italy.
Yeah.
It was very kind. Thank you, monks of Norcia, if you're listening.
Exactly.
Probably not.
And thank you, Trappist monks, for your excellent beer as well.
Thank you. Yes.
All right. So for the final part of our discussion today, we're going to talk about how to stock your bar. And we only have a couple minutes left to do so, but that actually works out just fine. Because basically, how do you stock your bar? By stocking it with the things you like to drink.
Wait a second. I got to get a pencil and write that down.
I know. It's difficult. But I often am asked this question, like, well, how do I start a bar? Well, start with what you drink.
Yeah. What do you like to drink?
Yeah.
Don't pick some random thing you don't like.
Exactly. So my favorite go-to cocktail is a martini. Alexandra, yours, of course, is a...
Manhattan.
Exactly. So we know that we need at least 4 bottles in our liquor cabinet.
I thought you meant of each. We're bad, but not that bad.
Gin and dry vermouth for the martini.
And then whiskey or bourbon and sweet vermouth for mine. Plus bitters.
Plus some bitters for you.
Manhattan. And I prefer cardamom bitters, thanks to our friends the Wards who turned us on to that. And then, of course, you need a couple of garnishes. So Mike likes not just an olive with his martini, but an onion too, which technically an onion in a martini makes it a Gibson.
That's right.
But you actually just kind of split the difference. You do a Martibson.
I'm a scofflaw. I'm a rebel.
I'm so rebellious.
Just mix it up.
You are just wild.
Yeah.
So an onion and
I live
an
on
olive.
The edge.
You do. Yes. Yeah. And meanwhile, I like very much the, for my Manhattan, the cherries, Amarana. I think they're Amarena. Amarena cherries.
We'll get back to you on that one.
We actually buy them on Amazon in a big tin. And the tin's really pretty too. And they last a long time as long as you don't refrigerate them, oddly. Yeah. They're just so good. They make the drink just really a treat. We only do that on really high holidays.
Yeah.
I don't know why. We're lazy.
So let me ask you, if you had to pick four main liquors...
Mm-hmm.
So we've already mentioned four, but like the vermouths aren't a main liquor.
Okay. So,
like to be versatile.
Sure. So if you, the most versatile things you want to have would be brown and clear. So you'd have whiskey or bourbon and gin. And then another clear would be vodka.
Yep.
And we actually don't drink a lot of vodka drinks. We can buy a bottle of vodka and it can sit there for a long time.
That's true.
What we do like so much, and we'll talk about this another time, is making our own fig vodka.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like it's the best use of vodka to steep figs in them. That's for a St. Augustine drink. And then what would be the fourth? Would be another brown?
I think rum.
Rum is an obvious one.
I was thinking two clear and two brown.
But what's another brown? Like, so one, a bourbon and a whiskey?
Like
brandy?
Yeah. And again, I'm thinking cocktails. If you wanted to have something neat, that's...
Neat meaning not with ice or as a cocktail.
Right.
The term neat.
Like a sipping whiskey.
Right.
So scotch... in general, I don't like the idea of putting scotch in a cocktail.
No.
I think that's...
It's too peaty.
Well, not only is it sometimes difficult to match it, it's just a waste, mm-hmm. right?
A good whiskey.
It's a waste of a good whiskey.
Yeah.
So...
I think the most basic answer would be rum. And then rum actually comes in clear and dark or even medium.
And yet... Rum cocktails aren't that big a deal anymore.
It's funny. We rarely drink that. But my parents are, 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And they do love rum cocktails, especially in the summertime. My dad will make, whatever it is with rum.
That is
like
true.
Like a hurricane.
Yeah.
That's rum, right?
I believe so.
Right. A dark and stormy.
Dark and stormy
is rum. Yeah. And he can just kind of mix up something pretty great with like pineapple juice and orange juice and rum. So I think that the obvious thing to answer is gin, vodka, whiskey or bourbon, and then rum. And then your various mixers.
Yeah. Boy, this bar is getting complicated, isn't it?
Keep it simple, spirit.
Exactly.
But it all boils down to what do you like to drink?
It does.
So maybe you have to go to a bar, and a good bar, and figure out what drinks you like best. But or go to a friend's house. And find a friend who's good at making drinks and ask them for advice.
That's true. I like it.
Compliment them and they'll invite you over. It's worked for so many people in
their
life.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for today.
I actually want to make one more shout out, can we?
Oh, sure.
One of the things you mentioned in Drinking with the Saints, available on Amazon, is Balcones Rumble for St. Bernard of Clairvaux. And Balcones Distillery is here in Waco, Texas. And we're huge fans. And they have been, we have a couple of their drinks. But their Rumble is a really special product.
Yeah.
And it is not really a rum. It's kind of its own thing.
That's why it's called Rumble instead of rum, because for rum to be rum in the United States, it has to be made from at least 51% cane sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And the creator, Chip Tate of Rumble, said, well, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So he made his rum from brown turbinado sugar, California Mission figs, and local wildflower honey. And the result is amazing.
We always say it tastes like art.
Yish.
It's really wonderful. Okay.
All right. So Mrs. Foley mentioned fig vodka a few moments ago. So next episode, we are going to devote our conversation to St. Augustine, whose feast day is August 28th. And we have some very special cocktails for him.
And I'm glad we brought it up, because if you want to make those cocktails with us, please look at Drinking with the Saints on how to make your own fig vodka, because it takes about 3 days to steep and it's so worth it. And it's, it's as expensive as some dried figs and a bottle of vodka.
Yeah.
And we recommend Tito's because it's in Texas, but it's also a great vodka. So if you want to join us, we hope you do. And please start making your fig vodka in honor of St. Augustine.
Lovely. To your health and holiness.
Cheers.